I start at a very fundamental point. The right to a shelter, to a home, is a fundamental right. Because certainly in our climate, if you can't get a home, you're dead. So the council housing is the way the government is supposed to meet its obligation, especially to less privileged people in society. Now, the bad things about the government's building programme and everything else is certainly the last time they wouldn't let the councils reinvest the money they got. So there's a housing shortage. Chicken and egg stuff. If you don't build enough houses, of course house prices go up. And there was, I feel it was a completely false market created by the last Tory government. It goes back to Thatcher, where she wanted people to rent. It's much easier to keep people who are renting in fear. Fear of their jobs, fear of their homes. It's very fundamental, but council housing has to be provided on an adequate scale for the government to meet its obligations under human rights law. So stick in there and, you know, force these guys to the wall. They have a fundamental obligation to provide housing. And picking off small groups, which is what they do, you know, they'll pick a little group up here in Bristol off. People need to combine and really make the case that there is an obligation on government to provide enough housing for everybody.
Now, we had a story last week from Inside Housing saying, I think it was roughly £400 million it would cost to actually guarantee housing for everybody in Britain. And that would mean every council across the country would be able to house people. Basically, I think they'd say it was about a month and a half you've got to give someone somewhere to live, to get them somewhere to live. And that's quite feasible for about £400 million.
When I raised it long ago, nobody took up the idea that Thatcher was forcing the capitalist housing market, you know, where people buy their homes, to one side, taking council houses out of the market, not allowing councils to replace them, meaning there was a larger and larger private rented sector, which is what the Tories are looking for, because they can put fear into the hearts of people who are renting.
Well, there is something out there called the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. Article 25 of that actually does guarantee the right to shelter.
Tony, when you get to the Queen's speech, a consultation on the Bill of Rights. The right to a decent shelter is in the ECHR, and the government want to abolish it.
Well, this week we're politician-free, we're journalists, and we're talking about the Queen, most of us. Martin, do you want to just give us your two halfpence on this whole business of selling off council homes and the housing market? Because it seems, and we were discussing this with Thangam Debonair last week, that there is a sort of obsession out there about keeping house prices going up and up and up. And when I say that, almost all economic policy seems to be centred around house prices. What's the actual effect of that? Is there actually any point to it?
Well, it has very deleterious macroeconomic effects. There's a bias in the system in Britain towards people buying their own homes, but not with subsidies being given for it. So, you know, Help to Buy being a classic example of that. And it's directed to those who are already relatively privileged, and they are going to be given extra resources or basically underwritten by the state to buy their own homes. And these tend to be swing voters in the marginal constituencies in our corrupt racketeering electoral system. And of course, in other northern European countries, people do not obsess about property ownership the way they do in Britain.
But what's the effect of only focusing on house prices? So, I mean, almost like the rest of the economy.
Well, hang on.
The rest of the economy can go to hell in a handbasket so long as house prices still keep going
up.
Well,
the classic problem is that you get big property price bubbles and bursts in Britain, and it's the geographical effect of that is largely concentrated in the south of England, places like Bristol, London, etc. And classically, you find that as the economy picks up out of recessions, house prices race ahead, and then they have to slam the brakes on to prevent inflation taking hold, and that, of course, prevents industry, particularly in the north of England, Scotland, the periphery of Britain, from competing in international markets. So all of our conservatories and DIY are at the expense of high-tech and manufacturing jobs.
No Prime Minister's questions this week. Instead, we had the State Opening of Parliament, the Queen turning up, and all of the MPs and quite a few of the Lords. I'm sure some of them are too old to go. And it's a sort of deathly silence. I'm reminded a little bit of Mervyn Peake's book, Titus Groan and Titus Alone, those kind of, where the whole kind of system seems to be ossified. Everyone's silent. People are making kind of meaningless statements. But thank God for Dennis Skinner, because he always breaks the monotony. And let's have a listen to that now.
Mr. Speaker, the Queen commands this Honourable House to attend Her Majesty immediately in the House of Peers.
Hands off the BBC.
Now, you know what he did, is he actually burst the silence completely there, and suddenly everyone's laughing and chit-chatting. So I think he plays quite an important role, Kevin.
Dennis has always played, often he's the lone voice, breaking up the consensus that nobody admits to and nobody knows how to get out of. Dennis is a great way of puncturing pomposity.
Martin, are you with me on this whole sort of deathly silence that's punctured by Dennis Skinner there? And I wonder what on earth would happen if there was nobody there to do that.
I think it's an astonishing contrast to Prime Minister's questions, which we said we haven't got this week, which is usually a roughhouse. Our whole constitution needs to be re-looked at. It's not fit for purpose. And being as we're facing the biggest economic, social, political, geopolitical crisis of the 21st century, it really is got to be changed.
Let's have a little listen now to the... we're going to break the Queen's speech down into a few sections now. And to begin with, and I want particularly, Martin, you to be listening attentively to this, because here the Queen goes into some of the economics, basically setting out the government's stall for the next parliamentary session.
My Lords and members of the House of Commons, my government will use the opportunity of a strengthening economy to deliver security for working people, to increase life chances for the most disadvantaged, and to strengthen national defences. To spread economic prosperity, my government will continue to support the development of a northern powerhouse.
Now, I did laugh at that northern powerhouse. I thought it had been sort of discredited. Martin, anyway, what are your thoughts about that, setting out the stall there for the next parliamentary session?
Well, obviously, what the Queen is there is being the ventriloquist for David Cameron, so it's not necessarily our own views. Let's make that clear to the people listening. Well, the most obvious thing today is the strengthening economy. But they've successfully bamboozled sufficient parts of the electorate to believe that the economy is, in fact, on the mend. I don't think it is.
Well, the figures actually say that there is modest growth now, don't they?
Yeah, very modest, so modest that if you...
Well, that means it's on the mend then, doesn't it?
No, it doesn't.
If there wasn't growth...
No, interest rates are at zero, and the deficit still remains out of control from their perspective. I don't think it's out of control, but they say it is. Now, in actual fact, in normal times, you would have regarded the situation where you have to have virtually zero interest rates for over 5 years as a pretty desperate corner to be in. Because, of course, it's ruining savers. You know, a capitalist economy cannot function in the long run on a zero interest rate. So with a zero interest rate, they've managed to squeeze out some kind of growth. And, of course, house price rises are included in economic growth. So, in other words, it's actually a delusion. And I'm afraid it's not going to last 5 years. Long before 5 years are up, we're going to be back in the soup. And real choices.
Well, look, you saying that makes me really worried, because I wonder how much of this growth is actually just purely house price inflation, really. It's not growth at all. There's here in Bristol, this is in an article this week in the Bristol Post by Emma Grimshaw. The city's housing shortage means the average cost of a home in Bristol is now a staggering £300,000. This figure's shot up nearly 25% in just 1 year. So if you've got house price inflation of 25% in 1 year, how much of that is going into the growth figures?
In other words, money is being made by estate agents, etc. But are we actually investing for a high-tech future, as was suggested in the Queen's speech there? And the answer is no, we're not. Levels of investment are abysmal. Productivity per worker has continued to decline or stagnate. the fundamentals of the British economy are weak. And we've had a 30% devaluation in sterling. And that should have led to a huge increase in manufacturing exports. But it hasn't, because we haven't got a manufacturing sector which can seriously respond to that stimulus.
Now, Kevin, you've worked on the Sunday Times Rich List. You know a few things about the economy. There are some people doing very well out of this. But what's your analysis of what the Queen is saying there?
I mean, the first thing is, we sacrificed, and it was a Tory government, Margaret Thatcher's government, that did it. 30 years ago, in effect, we abandoned high tech completely. Unfortunately, I was there to chronicle it. At the moment, the 10 or 20 largest high tech companies on earth, none of them are British. We are on the real coattails, and all this stuff about being a high tech producer, it's too late. We missed the boat. But we didn't miss it. We failed to invest. And the party that failed to invest was the government. Ordinary people here and there put money into projects and things. But the bottom line is the high-tech future that the Queen implied is total fiction. It's history. We missed the boat. We're in a rowing boat and we should be on a big ship.
What about, she's talking there about continuing the economic recovery. My government will continue the economic recovery. I mean, is your assessment that there is an economic recovery or not?
There's the economic recovery, and again, it comes around to, you raised the housing issue, and we can get around to that quickly. The economy can't boom if you haven't got certain basic manufacturing going on, you know, and things like high tech. We manufacture nothing. In high tech, really. We've got one chip company, a really good one, ARM. But that's about it. We need about 10. But to come to the housing issue, all the spare capital that ought to be available, especially at low interest rates, to invest in production and manufacturing, goes into housing. It's soaked off. Housing is very expensive because the amount of land available for housing is falsely constrained, and we don't even know, because of the way the land registry fails to function, we don't know how much land is available for development, and we can't find out. Therefore, you can't predict. What you can predict is, if there isn't an adequate supply of council housing and private housing, you get inflation in the market. And if interest rates are near zero, people can throw capital into it. It's not a good scenario.
Well, there certainly seems to be some moves here in Bristol to get large chunks of land which are owned by the City Council and social housing built on there of some sort, and we'll talk about that in a minute. But let's carry on with the Queen's speech, because I think in this section, if I'm right, she talks about the privatisation of the land registry. Here we go with the Queen's speech, looking at some of the more basic kind of domestic policies that she's setting out for this next term of Parliament.
In England, further powers will be devolved to directly elected mayors, including powers governing local bus services. Measures will be introduced to help the lowest income families save through a new Help to Save scheme, and to create a lifetime ISA to help young people save for the long term.
Well, all very well if you've actually got money to save. Martin, I suppose the most interesting amongst the comments there was this thing about anti-corruption, money laundering and tax evasion.
Yeah, I mean, it's rather amusing, isn't it, that we've hosted an anti-corruption conference in Britain when independent studies have shown that the City of London is the money laundering capital of the world. And I suppose if you are the money laundering capital of the world, you have to go through the motions of pretending that you're not, which is really what that boils down to.
What about tax evasion, Kevin? Because I would imagine that the Queen is not averse to putting some of her wealth in places where people can't get at it, maybe even her own private little dominion called the Cayman Islands.
Well, the whole system of offshore tax havens was the creation of essentially Edward VIII's courtiers to conceal his criminal involvement in the currency markets during the war. So the palace flunkies have had a big say in introducing the tax havens. But I'll give you a quote.
Sorry, what was he, just before you go on, what was he up to, Edward VIII?
Edward VIII, the Duke of Windsor.
The one who abdicated, he was very pro-Hitler, wasn't he?
Yeah, and he was more than pro-Hitler. He actually was on standby to reclaim the throne if Hitler had invaded. It's all come out now. But the key thing was, he was exiled to the Bahamas or somewhere.
Yeah, it was the Bahamas, yeah.
And he had this Nazi friend, a guy called Wenner Gren, and they used to play the currency markets. And that was illegal for the governor of, an island to do. So tax haven secrecy and no recording of transactions, no recording of ownership, all that started then. In 1990, in October, the Sunday Times ran a wonderful headline, "The Rich Don't Pay Tax." And this was taken up by Gordon Brown, Paddy Ashton, and then the leader. But they all approached the paper, and they kind of landed with me because I'd written the story. But Gordon Brown gave me a great quote once when I went to work with him for a bit. He said he would turn the tax havens back into holiday resorts. Lovely quote. And the people who stopped him were the Americans. They dug in. Gordon Brown made a genuine and good faith effort to tackle the tax havens, and he was stopped by the Americans. They only changed their position after 9/11, when it became clear that the Al-Qaeda was using the tax havens to transfer money around the place. But they haven't maintained their antipathy for tax havens. And of course, Martin, you say London's the biggest tax haven on earth. Well, there's a few others as well, like Delaware, Nebraska. You know, tax havens, internal tax havens in the major Western countries are a very serious problem too. It's very easy to pick on the tax havens. But
What about the Queen's role in actually being the head of state of many of these places? I mean, one of the things certainly I've seen again and again, and was a very good BBC documentary looking at the Cayman Islands particularly, was that at the end of the day, the Queen has got to be a major part, and the head of state has got to be a major part of reforming these places.
Feeling is that she reigns but has extremely little power, except the palace officials who seem to be opposing any reform.
Think, for example, in the Channel Islands, much closer to home.
Yeah.
The people down there will say, well, actually, the Downing Street and the Cabinet Office have very little jurisdiction down here. It's essentially all the major people who are running the Channel Islands are appointed directly by the monarch.
This is where we need, as media, as journalists, we need to get much closer. They're actually appointed by the Cabinet Office and by Downing Street. And it's to break into, to get insight into who's appointing them here. Because this is not to excuse the Queen or anything, but it's more important to find out who's really doing it. And the real doing is being done in the Cabinet Office and Downing Street. The Queen's just signing off on it.
Okay, let's move on to the next section, which I'm hoping again now we'll have something about the land registry in, where the Queen talks about more domestic policy, particularly here legislation that the Conservative government is planning over the next year to do with poverty and education, that sort of thing.
My government will continue to reform public services so they help the hardest to reach. A bill will be brought forward to lay foundations for educational excellence in all schools, giving every child the best start in life. Meeting the NATO commitment to spend 2% of national income on defence. They will also act to secure the long-term future of Britain's nuclear deterrent.
Kevin, yeah, we've strayed into the area slightly there of international stuff.
No, it's wonderfully aspirational. But take the one where she says that prison governors will be given unprecedented freedom, but no money. You know, the thing is in a way a joke. If the government is proposing to maintain austerity, but have all these aspirations, well, something doesn't match? Wouldn't we all love much better schools? Wouldn't we all love all our schools to be world class? That costs money. And there's no hint anywhere that the money necessary to achieve these goals is going to be made available.
Well, these new prisons often built under PFI yeah. contracts, Martin, and the news is out today, horrific news about the National Health Service deficit, £2.45 billion record deficit, and I'd imagine quite a lot of that every second of every day is going towards paying back these disastrous PFI bill contracts.
The good news is that it's not counted as government debt because it's all done as NHS trusts. Paying off their PFI debts is not national debt, it is the national debt. Say if they go bust, the state will have to step in and pick up the pieces.
So they're fixing the figures effectively
yeah.
again.
So it comes back to what Kevin was saying, a lot of this kind of aspiration is completely denuded by the economic policy that's being pursued.
Now,
in actual fact, we could afford to invest a lot in the things that we need to do, and it would actually be a useful thing to do in terms of improving both people's life chances and the economy. But you've got to throw out the window this ridiculous austerity obsession that they've got.
On prisons, there was quite an amazing idea, apparently, by Michael Gove, Kevin, about this is just this week in the news, about saying that prisoners should only go to their prison at the weekend.
Well, I mean, The Guardian weekly produces from the prison inspectorate, you know, horror reports. The prisons are dumps. They don't function. You know, re-offending rates are very high because people go into the prisons. They learn nothing except how to be better criminals, maybe. But again, you know, unprecedented freedom. Sorry, but no money. It's just, you know, it's PR. There's no substance in it.
Well, let's go to a final clip from the Queen's speech, which is developing on... Sorry, did you want to say something else, Kevin?
No, this is where she talks about the Human Rights Act. This is quite important.
My government will continue to play a leading role in world affairs, using its global presence. My Lords and members of the House of Commons, other measures will be laid before you. I pray that the blessing of Almighty God may rest upon your councils.
And there she goes for another year. Anyway, Kevin, yes, Bill of Rights.
No, this is traditionally, although not traditionally in the United Kingdom, traditionally Bills of Rights, like Declarations of Independence, arise from the people. They don't normally come from governments. And if they come from governments, they are normally a con. Now, at the moment, I'll demonstrate this because even I'm totally shocked by what happened. The Human Rights Act, as it currently stands, gives us a right to privacy. Good. When you try and actually enforce the privacy right, it doesn't exist. Legislation has completely eliminated the ability of an ordinary person to enforce their right to privacy. Over the American prison intrusion, I went to the Information Commissioner, who is actually in charge of our right to privacy in the Act, and said, they're doing this. And he said, buzz off. He absolutely refused to do anything. I didn't ask him to take action. I asked him to investigate, and he said no. So on that basis, your right to privacy is blown out of the water. But there's always the High Court. If you happen to have 10 to 20 grand in your pocket, how many ordinary families have 10 or 20 grand to go to the High Court and say challenge
Seem like with things like super injunctions that we've heard about this week that actually the law of Martin is increasingly only really accessible to the rich.
The Chief Justice of the United Kingdom has actually recently said that. But there's a problem in between. The legislation created in the House of Commons actually has the effect. The things that stop you saying, I want to go to that American company who registered here, stole my data, I want to take action against them. Well, your first stop is the High Court, and now good for you if you have 20 grand.
Martin, what about the sort of these international issues that the Queen has been bringing up there?
Well, talking about Ukraine and Daesh, I mean, presumably, you know, we're talking about the fault lines in the geopolitical world that we live in. And there's pretty strong evidence that British intelligence services were heavily involved in the initial coup in Ukraine, and also in arming and training the rebels, if that's what you want to call them, in Syria. So Roland Dumas, the former French foreign minister, is on the record as saying that he was approached by British officials before 2011, saying we're going to run an armed uprising in Syria. And what shocked me in the debate about Syria that we had some months ago, where the right wing of the Labour Party disgraced themselves, in my view, is that nobody mentioned that it's on the record that Britain has had the finger pointed at it by a foreign minister of France as being the instigators of the armed struggle in Syria. So when we talk about finding a solution to the Syrian crisis, perhaps we shouldn't have started the Syrian crisis in the first place. Assad isn't going anywhere. He never was going anywhere, and we've tried to remove him, and in the process, killed tens of thousands of people and created millions of refugees. What a great success for British enterprise.
Kevin, what do you make of that?
Quickly, in Iraq, we did almost the same, slightly different approach, the same thing. We decided we were going to remove Saddam, and what did we get? The collapse of a country, mm-hmm. 250,000 dead people, and millions of refugees. So what do we do in Syria? The same thing.
Instead of invading, we are.
Yeah, it's just crazy.
Okay, moving on to another one of these big stories at the moment, and when we mentioned the last few weeks, and actually we first reported with Simon Hines from London, a journalist from London, back in September last year. It seems to be slowly picking up. Laura Koonsberg at Newsnight doesn't seem very interested in it, but this is the leaked emails showing that the Conservative battle bus had the full support this week of the senior figures in the Tory party in the Daily Mirror. A controversial campaign was approved by Chairman of the Conservative Party Lord Feldman, ex-Deputy Chairman Stephen Gilbert, and election guru Linton Crosby. It now looks like something like 11 police forces investigating fraud at the last general election last year, Kevin, and certainly more than two dozen Conservative MPs may have to have by-elections. Some people in this may even go to jail.
Yeah, no, this story isn't even being run by The Guardian properly. It's Channel 4 really pushing it.
Yes, yeah. Michael Crick used to be on Newsnight, and he's now on Channel 4 News.
Ah, okay. Well, one of the victims, if you like, of the situation is the new police commissioner in Devon and Cornwall. It's crazy. She's been investigated by the Devon and Cornwall police over this issue in Torbay. But, again, the media are not giving us enough insight. The police have dived in on this. Think of all the things the police never touched. Think of the years of child abuse when a child trying to tell a policeman he was abused was told to shove off. The police feel, behind the scenes, that the government let them down over Hillsborough, and they're now going to have a go at the Tories. That, you know, there's a grudge match going on, and the media aren't bringing this out.
Well, Martin, the West Midlands Police this week became the 11th force to launch formal investigations into these allegations.
Well, I think presumably the political opponents of the Tory party have got vested interest in pursuing this, as well they should. And the police I don't really know what their motives are, but the fact is, if the Tories have broken election law, they ought to do something about it. But I understand that a lot of the constituents they were targeting were UKIP, were the main threat. So the UKIPers aren't happy, and that really does start the right fighting amongst themselves pretty successfully, doesn't it?
But since we're concentrating a bit on the head of state rather than the government or elected politicians, Kevin, you're a bit of an expert on the Queen's wealth. Why is she at number 229 on the rich list when she was top of the list for the first 7 years? Well, how come she's dropped down? Has she lost all her land, lost all her lost the crown jewels?
The palace phoned Rupert Murdoch about 15 years ago and said they didn't like her being at the top of the list and it wasn't fair. She didn't own the crown estate. You know, we, the compilers of the list, were confusing her public assets with her private assets. So if that was true then, it's certainly not true now. The government, the coalition government, handed the ownership of the Crown Estate back to the Queen. She owns the Crown Estate. The figure of 325 million, whatever it is, should actually have another 10 billion added to it. Because the Crown Estate is run for her, of course, and it's huge, and there's legislation and everything. But at the end of the day, she owns it. If she wants to sell it, she can. And it should be amongst her assets.
Okay, altogether, though, how much land does she own?
She owns everything legally, but personally, she owns a total of about 700,000 acres, about the equivalent of an English county.
So is that just here in Britain?
Most of that is in Britain. She may have over... It's always been rumoured that she has farms in the United States in horse country, but it's never been proved. The investments on behalf of... The private investments on behalf of the Crown are not revealed to anybody anywhere. We don't know.
This is a little bit like our very own merchant venturers here in Bristol, who under the Royal Charter that formed them in the 1500s, they don't have to actually file accounts at Companies House.
Yeah. But I think what we should say is, fine, the Queen is head of state. Well, she should make the same declarations as the Prime Minister. You know, she should list her assets, and all her senior officials should list their assets, and so on. This is what's missing. This is first step. It'll take a long time to unravel the legislation that grew out of history, like the merchant venturers of Bristol and the slave traders. That was all sanctioned by royal warrant.
Yeah, she's also, I believe, actually immune to prosecution. Is that right under law? I mean, we've got things like the Crown Prosecution Service, which is her service. She decides, well, not necessarily her personally, but Crown prosecutors decide who gets prosecuted. I imagine that's rather difficult for her to be prosecuted.
Well, there have been odd cases over about 100 years. Suppose for some peculiar reason the Queen decided to murder somebody, I feel nowadays she'd be prosecuted. Although in theory, and according to the Constitution, the unwritten one, she has got immunity. But I don't think that would survive the modern situation, unlikely as it is to occur. But I think what we should really be saying is, fine, you occupy a position that in other countries is elected, so let's have the same kind of declarations as Mr. Cameron makes. Let's have your tax returns, and let's have a list of your assets.
Martin, how come she's got away with this for such a long time?
Well, it's to do with the inertia of the British system, isn't it? The electoral system, the fact that the City of London is in fact independent of the government of Britain, we've got all these tax havens, the existence of the Crown creates a kind of grey area in which things like General Sir Walter Walker and sort of subversive military personnel can say, oh, well, we're responsible to the Crown, not to the government, and so forth. And
they've also managed to get away from any kind of freedom of information requests, haven't they, recently? Mm. I noticed. And there's a very good article in Business Insider from May last year by Rob Price. Queen Elizabeth II owns every dolphin in Britain, is the article, and doesn't need a driving licence. Here are the incredible powers you didn't know the monarchy has. And amongst those is she's immune from prosecution. All prosecutions are carried out in the name of the sovereign. She is both immune from prosecution and cannot be compelled to give evidence in court. In theory, the sovereign is incapable of thinking or doing wrong. Legal scholar John Kirkhope told Business Insider, however, barrister Baroness Helena Kennedy QC told the BBC in 2002 that nowadays that immunity is questionable. Although civil and criminal proceedings cannot be taken against the sovereign in a person under the UK law, the Queen is careful to ensure that all her activities in her personal capacity are carried out in strict accordance with the law, according to the official Queen's official website. If the monarch did commit a grievous offence, or she would almost certainly be forced to abdicate, there is at least one precedent of the courts prosecuting the sovereign. In the 17th century, King Charles I was tried for treason following the English Civil War. He said, "No earthly power can justly call me, who am your king, in questions as a delinquent." The court disagreed and had him executed.
Yep. Well, remember that the Queen entered evidence into court in that it was a very minor case, but was one of the butlers was supposed to have stolen Diana's stuff. And the next thing, the Queen gives evidence saying, no, no, it was all okay. So the case never went ahead. So, but I think the point that should the monarch commit some terrible offence, I don't believe the monarch would be immune in reality.